Since time immemorial, indigenous people have lived, traveled, and traded in the Puget Sound region. The Donation Land Act of 1850 to encourage westward expansion allowed American settlers to claim these traditional native lands. The explosion of immigration into the region that followed forced the U.S. government into a fraught treaty-making process with local tribes. The original terms of the Medicine Creek Treaty were inadequate and ultimately unaccepted by tribal leaders, resulting in war. The Indigenous Voices podcast is an extension of the award-winning Puget Sound Treaty War Panel series and Fort Nisqually Living History Museum. The podcast advances tribal voices in the telling of Puget Sound history and shares tribal knowledge and expertise with wider audiences.
Season 2, Episode 1 of the Indigenous Voices podcast focuses on the Fox Island Council, the reasons communities moved into this camp, and the conditions they lived in. Season 1 of the Indigenous Voices podcast explored the experiences of being Native in the Puget Sound region. Panelists discussed everything from food sovereignty to language revitalization, ending the season in a two-part episode about the monuments and memorials of the Treaty War throughout Western Washington. In the first episode of Season 2, panelists pick up shortly after the conclusion of the Treaty War with the Fox Island Council.
Hello, my name is Warren King George. I'm an enrolled member of the Muckleshoot Indian Tribe on my father's side, and on my mother's side, I descend from the Upper Skagit Tribe.
Nancy Bullchild, Nisqually Indian Tribe, Director of Archives and Tribal Historic Preservation Office, Tribal Member and Tribal Elder.
Haslakeo, Togalapu, Togalapo Deisha, Desiyaya Chalup, Brandon Raynon Titsta, Spoilapups Chud, Duflalu Dibadi, Director / THPO. My name is Brandon Raynon. Welcome. I am the Director and THPO for the Puyallup Tribe of Indians. I'm also a Puyallup Tribal Member.
Haslakeo, Takablu Sitsta, Spialabops Chud. Good day. My name is Takablu. I'm from the Puyallup tribe. My English name is Amber Taylor. I am the daughter of Eric Bennett and Carol Taylor, the granddaughter of Ramona Bennett, Clyde Bill, Patricia Taylor, and Al Taylor.
The internment camp on Fox Island was established, or at least during the treaty wars. The camp was established for those who were considered peacekeeping or who were non-warring, who didn't want to join in the battle, the physical battle that took place. Several leaders went over there, Chief Leshai being one of the warrior leaders. He took the group that wanted to go fight, and all the rest were forced onto the concentration camp on Fox Island that Stevens established. I'm not 100% sure, maybe Warren or Netsy can go into the background as why he chose Fox Island, other than just that it was across the way from the fort there, and a way for them to keep an eye on him is kind of what I presumed. But it was established so that a way of kind of wrangling everybody up so that they could keep us in one spot, keep an eye on us, and if you weren't on there, you were considered hostile. So even those people who just didn't really wanted to stay out of the battle, who just were just trying to continue to live, ignore it. They were considered hostile and often murdered for just trying to stay out of the conflict. You know, so those were more innocent people. You see that men and usually men were the warriors during this time, but we see plenty of accounts where Washington Territorial Militia and U.S. Army were taking out innocent villages full of children, women, and elderly. Obviously not warriors, obviously not in combat, but just trying to continue to live how they've always lived and just wanting to do that, live in peace. And they were considered hostile because they elected not to go to Fox Island. For those who wanted to do it, it was there, and those who stayed out faced death by the settlers. And then and age and gender were no stop for the settlers and their desire to conquer the land. So they wanted to clear us out, and if you looked like one of us, you were taken out.
Well, one of the things I'll add to that, Brandon, is According to Cecilia Carpenter's book, Tears of Internment, it says in there that under her was Indian agent Michael Simmons. Yeah, that he, and this is something I just learned, was that it was actually created as temporary reserve, which turned into internment camps, but there were others, but that was the intent. They were putting them there also temporary until they got the permanent reservations. So that's kind of how they started, and then ended up putting what they called the friendly Indians, because it was kind of, like she said, like a divide and conquer. If you weren't with the war, you know, Leshai and the warriors, you were considered, and weren't hostile, you were considered friendly, and then you went to an internment camp. You were forced, even your families. So that was their intent with temporary reserves.
Brandon alluded to this. The natives, I guess, who were not convinced, you know, that maybe the warriors, or maybe they had the right idea, but they just didn't have the manpower or weren't convinced about the war. I think another way to put it would be that there were elders and children who did not have the skills or the strength to line up with the warriors of the Medicine Creek Treaty War. And so those children and those elders would reside at Fox Island for their own safety. I mean, there's a number of ways to interpret that. One interpretation is that Governor Stevens, maybe he was aware of the true numbers of the Puget Sound natives, and perhaps he wanted to separate the natives who were not fully committed to this campaign for the Nisqually, Squaxin, and Puyallup and Muckleshoot. And so those natives were provided a location to live and remain in peace while this campaign moved forward. And I think some people say, well, Governor Stevens, he saw these true numbers and said, oh my gosh, there are a lot of Puget Sound natives who could provide a really strong challenge to his army and militias. And so perhaps one of the intentions was to reduce our army size, our fight size, by providing this Fox Island option for those who weren't fully committed to this campaign.
So my understanding of the Fox Island internment camp, basically there was two groups of Native people, right, during this kind of treaty war era. There was the hostiles and there was the non-hostiles. The non-hostiles were agreeably went, and I hate those terms, I really, really do, but that's the way that they are written and described about. Non-hostiles were the people that didn't essentially fight in the war or that had fought in the treaty war and eventually came to be with their family. It was supposed to be, this internment camp was supposed to be a level of safety for people. They were supposed to be taken care of. That was kind of the arrangement that was made. And my understanding is there was about 700 people that from all different areas that came to that internment camp. So according to Stevens, 700 non-hostile Native people that were on that Fox Island internment camp. Well over 100 of them died in that brief time that they were there. Really interesting. Okay, so as a young child, I grew up on Fox Island. I grew up in the inlet where Tanglewood Island is. It's also known as Grave Island. It's not far from the Fox Island Bridge. You could see the Fox Island Bridge from my house. We lived right on the water. And as a kid, I played in that area. We used to row a little boat over to Tanglewood Island and play off of rope swings. And that island was always really creepy to me. Later finding out that was a burial, that was where we buried. I mean, that was where we suspended our leaders up in canoes, and that was where we took care of our ancestors. And I never knew that as a kid growing up. So I never knew any of this history existed. It was never talked about. Even in the Fox Island Museum, not talked about whatsoever. There's no understanding of that. And it wasn't until later on when I read Tears of Internment. Yeah, so it was probably 15 or so when that book was gifted to me and I read that. And I was just completely in shock. Could not believe that all of this history had existed, that I'd spent a large majority of my life in this area and didn't know anything about it. as I've gotten older, my grandma's currently working on a memoir, so a book. And this is some of the information that we kind of explored. She wanted to know more, so I shared information that I had. But yeah, my understanding of Fox Island was that people were supposed to go there to feel safe for whatever reason. Maybe they had young children, maybe they were elderly. They were not part of that warrior class of people that were fighting in the treaty war. And so they went there and they were basically starved. I mean, they were on this island, unable to go harvest, unable to go out fishing. We all know Fox Island has pretty good clam beds or shellfish beds, or did at that time. So I imagine that there was a lot of clam digging going on and things like that, if the season was right. But yeah, they were starved. I mean, they were living on government commodities. Whatever the government was giving them is what they were surviving on. And many of them died. Many of them died from illness. Many of them died probably from starvation, from really not having access to resources.
Also, with Michael Simmons, that was one of the things that he did, was offered food to people that they were, you know, that were going on these islands. But he also made the statement that anybody that didn't go to these were considered fair game. So, you know, there was this way of scaring them and also luring them with food, because at the time, you know, where were they supposed to go? They were right in the middle of this war and had no place to go.
Right. That sounds right, Netsy. Because if I recall, Governor Stevens actually had a bounty on some of the heads of the lead warriors. You know, and that's where Patkanam from the lower Snoqualmie took advantage of that, or he heard about that, and he rounded up some of his warriors and cashed in literally on some of those, on that offer by Governor Stevens.
And also, even because they did fish and hunt and all that, it said that they weren't allowed either to leave the island to do that. So that, you know, like the only time the island was used was for berries and gathering, you know, shellfish, but that was in the spring. And at this time they were in the winter, but they weren't allowed also to do the fishing or hunting. So they were forced, you know, to take what they were given.
Kind of interesting. You know, a lot of these folks were rounded up. We were dispersed all throughout Puget Sound. So it wasn't like we were all in one little area and the warriors were over here and the other folks were over here in this one village, or that, you know, that we were spread all throughout. And so I think that there was a lot of promises that were going on at the time, a lot of arrangements being made on Stevens' behalf and by Stevens. And one of the arrangements was that, like I said, these folks were going to be protected and taken care of. And they also, in a sense, were used as collateral against these warriors that were fighting this treaty war. That was how a lot of them came back after, you know, after fighting, to come to the table for the Fox Island Council. They had their families there. They had, you know, mom, dad, grandma, grandpa, children, aunties, uncles. They had folks that were on this island in this internment camp that they hadn't had access to. They weren't able to cross over and check on. That was kind of how they came back to the table to really have that council meeting and have that discussion. And so they were just, you know, general people like you and I. When you think in terms of the treaty war and the locations and where that was happening, it was a little bit further inland. A lot of these folks were probably, you know, around the watershed, around Puget Sound. So, yeah, they're just regular people.
And there's a lot of records of, you know, many of them starving to death, too. Freezing or starving to death. You know, these were not just a... Yeah, you do think about the internment camps in at the Puyallup Fairgrounds, for instance, during the World War II. You know, those were nice. You know, they gave them places to live and and shelter and food and water. There was food, but there wasn't enough food to go around. There wasn't enough water to go around. There wasn't enough clothing and shelter to go around. So this is wintertime, and so a lot of these people who were being forced and relocated to this camp were starving and freezing to death. Men, elderlies, children. The territorial militia, Governor Stevens, didn't do anything about it. And it was another one of those ways of clearing the land. I mean, that he put them there to stay safe with the promise of food and protection. And that just wasn't occurring. It'd probably be more of a concentration camp, similar to what we saw in World War II from Nazi Germany. That was the environment that we were living in. So I don't know what you call them. I can't remember what they called those camps, but
yeah, those conditions sound, that sounds spot on, Brandon. Consider, you know, if now if we had to, in this day and age, if we were asked to pack up and move during the wintertime, you know, what would you take? You know, what's the primary, what would you grab, you know, other than your grandchildren to a place that's supposed to be safe, a place that was promised to be, have food and shelter? You know, you're going to take your prized possessions, which are your grandchildren or your great grandchildren. And you're just assuming that the word of this man is legitimate and that, you know, everything's going to be okay. But you're absolutely right. I think this was a horrible, horrible story, and a version of it. I think this would make a great chapter in those atrocities that occurred not just in the Northwest but globally to a number of cultures that were subject to the same treatment and the same ideologies that a lot of strange people embraced.
I think it's also important to, I know I've accidentally painted it wrong. You know, you think about they were driven here. They were driven to this camp. You know, gunmen would come into their villages and burn down their longhouses, burn down all their houses, all their resources. They had nowhere to go. They were being forced onto these two. They were, you know, you had no other choice. You know, and Warren alluded to it earlier. You had no choice. Where could you go? Your home had just been burned down. It's the middle of winter. They're promising food and shelter. So you had to go, because if you didn't, just like it was said before, you were fair game. Children. Listeners, you understand, children were, if they were not going to that camp, were murdered for target practice, for settlers, for militia. We have numerous of massacres were occurring. You don't see massacres heard about, but there are massacres occurring regularly in 1855 by the settlers, burning down our villages and killing for sport our people, our ancestors, our children, our elders who couldn't run. They were targets. They were used for entertainment, executed for entertainment by these militias. So what were we supposed to do? You know, those that could run and fight, they ran and fight. They joined Leshai. They ran and fought. And those who couldn't, like Warren said, they had no other choice but to survive. They had to go to this camp, and they faced horrific circumstances and horrific environments, but that's what they had to do. They had to endure that. And we're all here today because they endured those camps. They suffered tragic losses. Family members starved to death, but because they did that, we're here today.
And also, they talked about in order for you to leave, if you went off of that internment camp, you had to have a written permission note that they had to see in order for you to not get shot or for anything to happen to you. And then you also need to remember at this time, you know, you're talking about all these other internment camps and, you know, like all these other things. But this was the first, you know, and people should have took note of what happened to us, you know, because then it happened to others, you know, other minorities that endured the same thing. And it's a terrible thing, but they should have got a heads up from, you know, what happened to, you know, the first people here.
There was, I'm glad you mentioned that, there was an account in one of the ledgers from the fort that talked about a group of young Native men were shot and killed by the militia on accident. They had their papers, they had their passes with them, but they were still considered hostile. So even when they did leave and they did have the permissions, they did have that hall pass, no, the militiamen out there didn't care. You were brown, you were Native. You became a target and were automatically, without question, considered hostile. And the report talks about how when they were starting to clean up their murder scene, they came across their letters in the pockets. They didn't even get a chance to show them the letters. That's what the article doesn't cover. They didn't even ask for their letters that were in their pockets. They had permission to leave. They were following the rules. They were non-combatant, but they were not given that mercy.
And it's also noted that Governor Stevens and Secretary Mason, they were the ones that were in charge of that militia. They were the two in charge of that militia.
And those men now have lakes and rivers and monuments to their name, right? Way to honor murderers.
Yeah, that's a good point, Brandon. You know, Fox Island is what what the Pastaduzzi, what the Pastids call Fox Island. I think the word that our ancestors used for Fox Island was Bata'u or Bata'o. I don't know the translation for that. That would be maybe a good question to ask the listeners to do some research and define Bata'o and bring forward these historical events that took place right here, not across the Atlantic or across the Pacific. It happened right here in the Puget Sound. This is the dark truth. This is the dark history. And I think it's the time has come for a lot of the descendants and a lot of our neighbors here that now call Puget Sound home. It's time for them to realize what efforts were done to make these opportunities for them to live here. That's where it began. That was the whole point. Why did this happen? What was the intent? What was the purpose? Simply the bottom line was to remove Native Americans and to secure the land for opportunities for our new neighbors. And I'm being polite there.
You know, there's just always this history that wasn't told, you know, and the question is always, why don't the tribal people know? Why don't non-tribal people know? But it's back to that. The tribes didn't have schools of their own. You know, it was oral history. You know, everything was passed down. But when you're getting in trouble for speaking that, these things don't get passed down, you know. And because there was no schools for the tribes, you know, they had to go to the public schools. The tribes had no control over what the public schools taught, you know, and today we're still fighting with that, you know, as far as what's supposed to be taught in these schools. So that's where a lot of this gets lost. You know, there is history about it, but where do you teach it? You know, where were we supposed to teach it? Who were we supposed to tell when? And I tell people when we do presentations, it's very hard to get an elder to talk, to be interviewed, because they don't want to talk about it, you know. So you have to have the right people, the right atmosphere for them to be willing to be open about it, because, you know, there was so much trauma. So that's where you don't get this being passed down tribally and non-tribally. So that's why we're here.
There is some good highlights for us. They didn't talk about the camp, though. Leshai, knowing he was a very highly prized target of Stevens, went on the island twice and visited the people that were on the camp, the prisoners, I guess you could say, lifted their spirits. You know, his stories of the battles had obviously gotten back to the camp. And as a little bit of taunting Stevens, I think, you know, we tend to do that, where each of us think and relate to taunting those who are bugging us a little bit. And that's why twice shows up on the camp under disguise, and Stevens learns about it, gets very upset. You know, you had him and he was at the camp and you guys let him go. You know, he snuck on there twice, you know, lifted up his spirit. So, I mean, even then, even those times are, we were trying to lift each other up. We're succeeding. Those visits, I'm sure, helped those prisoners, you know, get their spirits lifted a bit.
Yeah. I wanted to respond to, Netsy hit on something there that I thought was interesting. And that was well said, Brandon. Netsy, you mentioned something about our elders and how, and their, sometimes their reluctancy to share. And that statement is true to this very day. Unless you're very familiar with the elder, unless you're on a first name basis with them, that's literally the only time you're going to get them to open up about their experiences, their testimonials. That's how you're going to get to know them. And I believe this is that those characteristics were conditioned by our non-native neighbors. That was the intent, right? That was one of the objectives and one of the goals was to make sure that these elders and that these young people, that they no longer associate themselves with our traditional and our cultural ways. And so what my elders call Gwadzadad is the traditional teachings. These traditional teachings and values were driven out of them. That opportunity to learn the old ways and to learn the language and to learn the culture, that was on purpose. And it started during this Medicine Creek Treaty War era, and that during that campaign to remove the natives from their homeland. So that was part of the whole idea, and which I think some of us can define that as genocide.
And you also find in when, you know, you read a lot of the testimonies from like land claims, you know, all of these different things that happened to tribes, you'll see where they had to bring elders into the court and get a testimony because they didn't know how to write. They didn't know how to speak good English. So you had to have somebody in there, you know, being able to ask the question in a way that they understood and that they could speak it in English. Because some of them that did still have their language, they didn't know the English word for some of these questions that were being asked. So you can kind of imagine how that went with the treaty. You know, these people were just like, what does that mean? You know, the word could take on different meanings for different tribal dialects. So that's where it's hard because you really have to go through and do all of the research in different areas just to find where an elder, which we would probably call our ancestors now, are speaking, but it's very limited. It's if they understood it, and they would call things what they were used to calling them in the English, in the native language, you know, in their tongue. So to us, we have to go back and look up, where is this place? You know, what are they talking about? Because I've never heard of it. But then I have to really dig around and find the research on, oh, now I know where they're talking about, you know. So there is still today where it's really hard for us, I think, you know, us that are sitting here now, to go in and decipher some of this. You know, it's all by interpretation. So you really have to look thoroughly just to find out what they were talking about, what they meant, you know, if what they said was really what they meant, you know, depending if they understood the question, you know. So that has a lot to do with all of these things that are brought down too. So I feel those ancestors at that time, I would be you know, feel very self-conscious trying to say something and have people keep repeating, what do you mean? You know, what are you talking about? Where are you talking about? You know, so, I mean, I get nervous just coming to these things and I'm not even in person, but you know, that's, I can just see them being on the stand, asking all these questions about their land, about their people, and not really being able to speak, you know, the language fluently to get across what they're trying to say. So we lose some of that, you know, that history. And we're trying, you know, like I said, I just really dig around and try to find everything I can to see what these things mean that they're talking about.
You're absolutely right, Nessie. To this day, doing presentations to cities and historical societies, etc., to this day, I still encounter non-native elders who challenge some of my statements, who challenge some of our history. And it can be uncomfortable, but like our original warriors, like the warriors that we descend from, you know, you just stand your ground. Say, look, I mean, I've been invited here to talk about my history, our history. I'm not here to defend your actions or to oppose your feelings or your opinions. I'm simply here to share our true history. So, and to this very day, in 2024, there was I did a presentation to the city of Des Moines, which is full of retired fishermen, commercial fishermen. So you kind of get where I'm going with that one. And that was really interesting for a full hour.
You know, the other thing that does affect what we're doing is also, what we're doing right now is instant media. Back in the day, on our younger years, you know, there was all of these movies, you know, with the stereotype. And it's so hard because that's what everybody thinks the way it was, you know, and we still get that today. And like me and JoJo, who was, you know, on the NAB, we were all like, we're past that. We've got all that, you know, we're trying to get rid of the stereotype. But, you know, we do have people that still apologize because they're like, you know, we seen what was in the movies. And I'm like, we know that, but that's not true. So, you know, they all take that into, you know, when you see that, it's, well, that's what they were doing. They were just killing everybody. You know, these Indians, all these tribes were just killing all these white settlers and everybody that came in. And so that's really another thing that really hurt us. But by doing something like this, I think it helps us to get all this stuff out in the same way.
By the summer of 1856, Stevens was, and the militia, the U.S. military, they were losing battles. They were realizing that, you know, this was supposed to be a quick, swift thing, and it wasn't happening. Stevens sends letters to D.C. asking for reinforcements, and, you know, I think there's a famous letter from Minnie Penny, who's like, you ain't getting it, buddy. You know, this should have been done by now. What are you doing wrong? And your job was to clear the land. Your job was to get these Indians out of here. What do you mean you need more money? What do you mean you need more troops? These are just low Indians here. They're not like us. They're not blah, blah, right? So Stevens is like, well, I got to do something. And so Stevens actually does call the Fox Island Council, gathers all together, asks for, you know, requests that Leschi and all the warriors come in and talk with the leaders that are already at the Fox Island Council for Puyallup. Squatahan, he was there representing the Puyallup people, you know, and he, with several other leaders of the Puyallup and Nisqually, Squaxin, Muckleshoot, several other leaders from the tribes that were there, you know, and so that the council's convened because Stevens needed something then. He realized that we were starting to take over. We were starting to, we knew the lay of the land. We knew where to find resources and we knew all the secret spots. We've been hunting these lands since we were kids, you know, at that time. So we knew all the places to hide. And we just kept getting more warriors. You know, we kept getting reinforcements from Kamaikid and the Yakimas across the mountain. We kept getting reinforcements from the coast and from the north. And whereas the militia wasn't getting that, even the U.S. military, the army, was struggling to keep supplies. We were sabotaging their routes for resupplies. You know, we had the food and the warriors had the food and when they were hungry, they would just rob the supply chains, you know, and so they were being defeated. And instead of facing defeat, he decided, let's call this a truce and call a council and let's talk about what's going on here. That's where he convened the Fox Island Council in, let's say, August of 1856. By that time, 18 months worth of battles have been taking place. We had lots of losses, but so did the militia. But I think their morale was much lower because of what we were doing to them. We weren't letting them sleep. we were hunting them at night and taking out their generals at night. And so I think we were trying to wear them down. And so instead of facing defeat, he called the council. But again, you know, going back to our previous point, you don't see this in the history books. You don't see movies about about the mighty U.S. Army and the clandestine, the settlers being defeated.
When everybody came together at this Fox Island Council and you read what was written, right? Because there was somebody taking, you know, notes about, it probably was Gibbs at the time, taking notes of what was happening at this Fox Island Council so that it could be sent back to the president. Just the kind of savior complex that Stevens had, you know, like, oh, shame on you guys. I told you I'd give you everything you wanted. You know, why would you do this, you silly children? I mean, it's just, it's really interesting the way that he communicated and whether or not our people understood what he was saying. But when you reread it, it's pretty, like, pretty gross.
For Puyallup, I know our leaders wanted, you know, the reservations that were proposed in the treaty. Like all of us are going to the same story, but well, especially Muckleshoot, but they were lands that weren't suitable. We did the math real fast. Wait a minute. Every white guy here gets 640 acres and there's 900 of us and we get 120, you know, we did that real fast. But then for Puyallup, the reservation was up on a point. Today it's up near Stadium High School. So it's a really high bluff, a couple hundred feet above water, above the salt water. There was no like easy access to the salt water. There was no fresh water source. I think there's a little gulch today. I think they call it Puget Gulch, I think is our Garfield Gulch, which didn't have a lot of water coming through it. So again, there wasn't anything there to survive. So our leaders that, you know, they wanted access to the water. Chief Squatahan was really fighting for, he wanted access to all the ancestral lands in the area for his people. So the sacred sites, he wanted sacred sites. He wanted gathering sites. He wanted the trails. So we could maintain our way of life as much as possible, even though it was here in this new format. But he wanted access to burial sites. He ended up requesting lands all the way out to present day Alderton or Ording area, all the way down to Fern Hill from Tacoma, Point Defiance down to Fern Hill, out to Alderton, Ording area, out to Dash Point. That was the lands they wanted. That encompassed what, it, you know, for him and the surviving Puyallups, that was what they considered to be their important sites. That was their homelands. That's what they, so that's what they're negotiating for. They're negotiating for territories to fish, territories to hunt that they could still gather. I think they were looking at the land that was available. They probably had a good understanding of what the natives were, the non-natives were kind of settling around and the areas that they could use and still be able to survive. So those lands provided game, they provided berries, they provided cedar, they provided shellfish, you know. So yes, we're being shrunk down and onto these little reservations, but at least we could carry on our way of life. And then they trusted, you know, that this would happen, that if they went and agreed to these reservations, that they would always have these lands. And that was an unfortunate trust that our leaders had in the Stevens and the non-natives that we will talk about later, how that didn't happen. But their main goal was just to get their way of life, to preserve as much as they could on an area that they could do it and survive with the amount of people they had left and hopes of growing. Like, I think they wanted more land for the reservations because we had intended on growing and continued living. We knew we only had, for Puyallup, we only had 900 members left. We knew that we wanted to continue to grow at that point. And so putting us on 120 or even 600 acres was not going to be large enough. So we wanted more lands and more lands that provided for our way of life so we can continue that.
So if you go back to the treaty, also when Governor Stevens came and made all these promises, you know, that's what we always, there's always this discrepancy because of documentation. But, you know, when he first came, he promised these lands, these reservation lands. So then you go, you get into the internment camps where, you know, Michael Simmons says, okay, these are all temporary reserves, which turned into internment camps before we do the permanent reservations. So then at treaty time, you know, that was one of the things Leschi and all the other leaders argued was that, you know, this isn't where you promised to put it, you know, because they wanted the river, the prairie, you know, they knew the place, that's what they were told. Then it comes back and that's not what they got. So then they walk away, you know, you have the war. So then what happens is then Stevens now, you know, because of all these letters going back to Menapenny, there you go, because they were told you guys are there to help the tribes, you know, the Indians, you're supposed to protect and serve them. And that's not what they were doing, you know, but because the communication took so long, they didn't know what was happening from Washington, D.C. back to this Washington. So then, you know, Stevens gets into this, okay, we're going to have a council. Well, if you go to this island, where are you going to? You're going to all these people that have been starving, that don't have their native foods, you know, that can't even hunt and fish. And you're going to talk to them. So yeah, some of them were like, we want off of this place. You know, clothing was bad. Everything was bad. And so same thing. So he does this big old speech, which I do not like. But, you know, he does this another speech of promises that now we're going to talk about permanent reservations. But, you know, that was supposed to be at the beginning, not at the end. And so he did have to save face. And like I said, my son Curtis will say, you know, if Stevens, you know, maybe if he would have said, what if he would have became Leschi's friend, things might have turned out different, you know, but he didn't. He didn't listen to those leaders that said, you know, and Leschi did say that. He says, my people won't survive. You know, they'll die if they don't get the place. And that's how all those leaders felt. You know, that was the reason for the war, was because they wanted the place where they knew they can hunt and gather, you know, live. And that's not what happened, you know. So this was kind of his, oh, now I got to make amends, you know, and I'm going to make these promises that I made in the first place, you know. But you have to look at it, what, the internment camps, I think they were 13 months. So it was over a year that they were on these camps. Putting it in that perspective back then, you know, it was a different era and different times. But, you know, these people were saying, we just want to go home, you know. So you would agree, you know, like I said, they always put him in this between a rock and a hard place. And what are you going to do? So to me, that was just all on Stevens. You know, he could have, this didn't have to be, but that's what happened.
So you can access the council minutes on the National Archives. They have digitized them. So you can access the full kind of archival file of what is included in the Fox Island Council. And it's kind of a mix of documents. It also kind of goes back into the original reservation boundary and some maps and different things that are in there. But the written word is Stevens, when he's talking to us, says, I will not lie, right? He's telling everyone, I will not lie. And then on the written document, there's like this little upscore or something that says, try, I will try not to lie. So even in the, I mean, these are the written documents. These are the documents that were sent to DC. These are what's digitized at National Archives. So even then it's, I will try not to lie. Like that was an afterthought because he knew he was gonna, he knew he was lying. He knew it was, I'm your great white father and I'll try not to lie. And I hope that you, that you'll be honest with me as well.
Muckleshoot's position was very similar to Brandon and Netsy's. You could apply those statements to Muckleshoot's sentiments as well. But one huge difference is that the Muckleshoot, or what we know as today as Muckleshoot, they didn't have a reservation. There were no lands set aside. There was no consideration for their watersheds or their river systems that they were accustomed to. And so that was one of the big drivers for our involvement in the Medicine Creek Treaty War. You know, that's no offense to our neighbors, the Puyallup and the Squally, and even the one to the north, the Tulalip. It's not that we didn't want to move there. It's that why would we give this up? Why would we want to move to someone else's home? You know, I don't mind visiting Puyallup and I don't mind visiting the Squally, but I prefer to live here in these river systems here that my ancestors have been utilizing, like Brandon referenced. Our ancestors have been using these river systems, these water systems for generations, for thousands of years of continued use. And we're asked to give it up and move somewhere else. So to me, that just sums up the reason why the what we know as today, the Muckleshoot people were, and their warriors were involved in the Medicine Creek Treaty War. Because we didn't get anything until our warrior leaders stepped up and said, hey, this is not going to be adequate. I mean, you heard Puyallup didn't get what they wanted in the beginning. Nisqually didn't get what they wanted in the beginning. And Muckleshoot didn't get anything. So what more incentive? I mean, that's all the incentive you need. Because essentially what you're going to do is you're going to wipe out these people, wipe their entire villages out via starvation and via forcing them into these living conditions that can't support human life. You know, how long can you live in a wetland or a swamp? I guarantee you it's not going to provide generations of wealth. So that's why we were backed into a corner. We got to do something. And so our elders said, let's get what we want. And that leads me to this statement. You know, Muckleshoot is actually a place name. It's not a village. The term Muckleshoot is referenced to a prairie, or even a blockhouse that was placed on the prairie was named Fort Muckleshoot. So it's actually a place name. It's not the name of a village. Muckleshoot is made up of all of the villages on Lake Washington, Elliott Bay, Duwamish River, Black River, Green River, White River, South Prairie, and Upper White River. So all of those villages that made up those neighborhoods, I refer to as neighborhoods, but were their independent villages. That's what Muckleshoot is today.
You think about how ignorant Stevens was, not understanding the dynamics of the villages. We weren't all one type of native. You know, you had the prairie villages that had their way of life. They had the sound, the water, the saltwater people. But, you know, so they had their different ways of life. And so Muckleshoot is like, well, we don't live over there. That's not where we live. We're fighting for our homelands over here, you know. So Stevens was just so one-sided in his linear in his thought process, you know, that he just said, oh, all Indians want to live on the water. All Indians want to live here. And these lands are just the best lands we can put. Well, I shouldn't say there. These are the lands that we should put them on. This is all that they deserve. And he underestimated, I think, our pride, our desire to continue to live, and underestimate our gumption for getting what we want.
The idea of a boundary didn't really exist before the Donation Land Claims Act, you know, like even with the fur trappers and, you know, all of the kind of explorers that had come to the area, that idea was very foreign to us. We didn't have an idea of like, let's fence in this little block of land and this is where we're going to live in and farm and whatever their ideal was, that they wanted us to become agricultural farmers. And that was a foreign idea from the very beginning. Well, part of the Medicine Creek Treaty was this agreement that the land would be reserved forever. It would be our children's 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 children would be able to inherit this land and be safe there and have a place always. So that was really the general idea behind the negotiation and the treaty agreement. But even when it comes to like harvesting practices and being able to move throughout the Puget Sound area, just having this one little block of land is just a very foreign idea.
Also, you know, that gets back to with the tribes, that was their teaching was oral history. You know, these stories were passed down generation to generation. How can you pass down a story that you're not even on that place? Plus, some of the people that have written about tribes talk about how they learn tribes highly take care of their dead. You know, okay, now you're talking about, okay, you expect us to move all of our people? I mean, my grandpa and my uncles had to do that just when the Fort Lewis at the time, what, you know, was condemned, that part of the Nisqually land. But that was one of the things they said. They said, they're not leaving their dead. You know, they're going to move them. And they had to move them. Who else does that? Who else, what other, you know, people do these things? But how do you pass down a story about, we used to go to this prairie and do this, or we used to go to this place and fish, or we used to go over here? How do you pass that down when you're not even on, you know? And that's why I said, relocation is a big issue. You know, people, everybody should look at Trail of Tears to see some of the, you know, that's the most well-known. But that happened to a lot of tribes. You know, they're relocated. And to go and do what they're doing today, you know, I even question, I'm like, why are they over there? Then I have to look at the maps and look at stuff like, oh, they were relocated. So people also don't talk about that. But it's like, how do you teach your next generation? You know, this is where we used to do this. This is where we used to go. This is what you do. Luckily, my husband, who's Blackfeet, you know, a lot of theirs was left that way. So he has that knowledge where he can go to these places that, you know, his dad taught him where their people used to go. So some have that. But, you know, that's the other thing about that. You know, you had these ceremonies, you had all this stuff. And, you know, we had first salmon ceremony. You know, they don't have that in Blackfeet country, you know. So that's a part of what they weren't understanding, was like they just put us all in the same and said, oh, they'll be fine just as long as they have land. And that's not how it was.
Hey Sheba, Hisquo, for joining us for the Indigenous Voices podcast. Indigenous Voices is available wherever you get your podcast. Follow and subscribe at fortnisqually.org.
This podcast is generously supported by the Pierce County Historic Preservation Grant,
as well as representatives from Squalapupsh, Dusqualiopsh, Squaxin, and Bukalshuthopsh.
Music by Vincent Johnson, Nooksack, Lummi, and Nishani Johnson, Jamestown, Sklallam, Lummi.